From the campus of Weber State University in Ogden, the Utah Debate Commission welcomes you to the first Congressional District Candidates Debate.
And good evening. I'm Ken Verdoya, and I'm honored to accept the invitation of the Utah Debate Commission to moderate the first exchange in their schedule for the 2014 election season. We are live on the campus of Weber State University in Ogden for a debate between candidates in Utah's first congressional district. Tonight, we will hear from the incumbent, Republican Representative Rob Bishop, and his Democratic challenger, Donna McAleer. Each candidate receives a two-minute opportunity for an opening statement, and prior to airtime, it was determined that Donna McAleer would have the first opportunity.
I'm Donna McAleer, and I'm running to represent you. The people of Utah. When I was 17, I made a decision to serve our country. I applied and graduated from West Point, was commissioned in the Army, and stationed overseas in Germany. For me, it was a simple decision. I believe in the freedoms we share and the opportunities afforded to us all, and I'm dedicated to preserving those freedoms and opportunities. The ideals of integrity, service, and commitment to a mission guide me here today. Having led a global division of a technology company and created jobs in the supply chain, turned around a Utah healthcare organization, served on various not-for-profit boards, and volunteering at my daughter's elementary school, I understand the importance of community and its impact on us. I've actually had to work with other people, developing results that help a community. And given the present gridlock in Congress, we need people who know how to work together and deliver results. I've traveled throughout Utah, and I've listened to your concerns. You've told me Utahns are angry with Congress. You're tired of the gridlock and polarization. You want Congress to do its job, get things done for you. That's the work I will do. We need leaders who will not pull political stunts and take money out of people's pockets and throw them out of work. Voting to shut down the government for 16 days last fall was wrong. It was a political stunt that hurt our state and our country, costing Utah $30 million and furloughing 40,000 workers. Congressman Bishop helped manipulate the rules to keep the government shutdown going and voted against the bipartisan compromise that would have ended it. He believes our biggest fight is against the federal government. Our biggest fight is strengthening our economy and improving our schools. I will work with you and everybody. I will be accountable to you. I'm Donna McAleer. Together, we can work together to fix Congress, stop the political gamesmanship, and move Utah forward.
And now, a two-minute opportunity for Representative Rob Bishop.
Hey, thank you. I'm Rob Bishop, the congressman in the 1st District. I live with my wife in Brigham City, where we raised 5 kids and have 6 grandkids. I've lived my entire life in northern Utah because I like Utah, and I'm proud to be a resident of this state. I served in the legislature, where I retired as Speaker of the House and learned to dislike federal mandates coming down on state government. I also served 28 years as a public school teacher, where I realized the importance of local control on education. But more importantly, when you put 5 kids on missions and through college on a school teacher's salary, I learned something about what it takes to be frugal at the same time. So as much as I appreciate the invitation to be here, this election is really not about me. It's not about the Democrat candidates. It's not about the candidates who were not invited to participate. It's about you. This is still your Congress. It is your government. It is your future. It will be your opportunity to decide who has the principles and the experience to best represent you in Congress. When I go back to Washington, there are certain false narratives that actually exist back there. One is that only a Washington bureaucrat has the vision to know what is right for this country. If there's ever a conflict between a local government official and a Washington bureaucrat, obviously Washington has to win, and that the West needs to be protected from itself. I despise and deny all of those narratives, and I have appreciated your willingness to send me back there and put me in a position where I can do something about it. I'm not flashy. I'm not a show horse. I'm a workhorse that actually tries to accomplish things, and not to consolidate power in Washington, but move that power back to local and state governments and to the people so that you have more options, more choices, and more control in your lives. That is what I have tried to do in the past, and that is the goal I still have for the future. I appreciate the opportunity of being here with you.
Thank you, Representative. The Utah Debate Commission has established a format that allows each candidate 90 seconds for an initial response to a question. Now, these questions were drawn from voter input to the Utah Debate Commission website. More about that in a minute. But first, our first question will go initially to Representative Bishop and then Donna McAleer responding in kind. As we meet on this Tuesday, Americans are receiving reports of coordinated military strikes in Syria led by the United States aimed at the forces of the Islamic State, known variously as ISIS or ISIL. For the preliminary indications of success, most military analysts believe an air war cannot resolve the conflict with ISIS. Tell me what you would support as policy toward ISIS, and where and how would you draw the line in military action? Representative Bishop, the first opportunity.
The threat that is given by ISIS is real. The terrorists are evil. They have threatened Americans. They have acted against Americans. They threaten America and our allies, especially in Europe. So sitting back and doing nothing is not an option. Allowing them simply to have free rein in the Middle East so they can plan attacks on us is simply not an option. As we're going through this, there are several concepts that we should have. One is the fact that there were airstrikes today. For the first time, F-22s were used, and they were used successfully in battle and combat, and I just wish this administration had not cut the number of F-22s that were produced and actually given the Air Force what it really wanted in that. If we are to go into battle, we have to make sure that the men and women who are actually fighting those things have the infrastructure and have the supplies they need to be successful. If we go into battle, then it is important that we as a government, first of all, state our objectives very clearly, which is something I wish the Congress and the President still has to do, and then also turn it over to the military for the most effective way of actually fulfilling that concept and going forward. What happens in the future will depend on what we need to happen in the future, but the fact that we have taken it to this terrorist group is something that is appropriate and needs to be done, or it will come over here.
Donna McAleer, your initial 90-second opportunity.
Thank you so much. So, yes, to our brave servicemen and women conducting those airstrikes. The first thing I would have done was stayed in Washington and actually had a full debate and discussion about this topic. When we commit any kind of forces, we need to thoroughly understand both the short-term and the long-term strategic objectives. I was actually in D.C. last week at a federal committee meeting of the Defense Advisory Council on Women in the Service. And yes, your Congress did take a vote, but they got out of town pretty quickly before understanding all the impacts. The answer in Syria and the Middle East is not a U.S. military one. It has to be a political one. One of the benefits of what happened today was that it is part of a broad coalition, including five Arab countries who are predominantly Sunni. However, we know our air power is far superior. So their involvement was important from a legitimacy and a credibility standpoint, but we don't exactly know what they've actually done. Syria will be a complicated area. We have an ongoing civil war there with a government we don't support, a veritable Star Wars bar scene of anti-government groups that change leadership daily. We have unfamiliar territory, a culture, and religion, and an international community that wants action but is slow to move. We should be debating this topic thoroughly. One of Congress's most sacred jobs is to make a decision of whether or not we send our military into action.
Now, the format allows for rebuttal time for each candidate or the discretion of the moderator to offer a follow-up question in the same 30-second period. And so I'll exercise my discretion right off the bat by saying the most repeated phrase in this political season when it comes to the military seems to be no boots on the ground. Neither one of you addressed that concept in your response. Tell me how boots on the ground, troops affecting land actions, is or is not a part of your consideration of ISIS. Representative Bishop, the first 30 seconds.
That decision is not one for a politician to make. It's one for our military generals to make on what is necessary to be successful once we have identified what the target is supposed to be. Congress did debate for 2.5 days this particular process, and the resolution was passed was one that was worked out by leaders of both the House and the Senate, Republicans and Democrats. This direct answer to your question can't be given now. It's going to be done when we assess what the situation is and what is necessary. But nothing should be ruled out prematurely.
Donna McAleer, your opportunity.
We've seen from more than 12 years of war in the Middle East that air power alone is not enough. However, before ever committing our servicemen and women in any country, we need to fully understand what we're trying to accomplish, what the objective is, and what the exit strategy is. And that advice comes from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and his chiefs. There's no way to answer that question now. A much longer debate and discussion is required before we commit our troops in harm's way. But our military should always be the third use tool in national policy, not the first and not the second.
Donna McAleer, you'll have a first opportunity to respond to this next question that came once again from the voting public. A substantial portion of the land in Utah, over 60%, is owned by the federal government. State legislators in Utah passed a bill calling for the transfer of millions of acres of public lands to the state. Opponents of the bill say turning public land over to the state will result in mismanagement. Who should properly control the now federal lands in our state? Your first 90-second opportunity.
Well, as we all know, Utah is home and blessed with some of the most spectacular land and landscape in the world. Visitors come from around the globe. Our national parks and natural resources generated over more than 9.5 million visitors, bringing more than $600 million of revenue into this state. It's a historical fallacy and myth to think that these lands were owned by Utah. They never were. And so when we have a debate about this, we really have to start from understanding the law and the policy. These lands in the Enabling Act were given to the federal government, and Utah forever disclaimed the right to those lands. So when we hear language like taking back the federal land, suing the federal government for control of the public land, it is a historical fallacy, and we need to begin that discussion with an understanding of the law and the policy. Remember, our outdoor recreation industry and travel and tourism is one of the largest drivers of our economy in this state. And we need good policies to manage and protect and steward that land for future generations and our children's generations and my daughter's children.
Thank you, Donna McAleer. Representative Bishop, your opportunity to respond to public lands.
Look, Utah is a public land state, always has been, always will be. The issue is not whether we should be a public land state. The issue is simply who is going to make the decisions on how those public lands are used. And that should be the people who live in the area where those public lands are. Those are Utahns who should make those decisions. And anyone who would say that Utahns are not competent to make those decisions is simply whistling in the dark. That is not the way it was supposed to be. The Enabling Act that was just mentioned was an Enabling Act that was common language in almost every Enabling Act for every state except for the original 13 that entered this nation. So it's the same language North Dakota had and Nebraska had and Alabama and Florida when they were given their lands back from the federal government, because it was language that was there as a quit deed concept because the federal government sold those lands to make money. The West was not treated the same way that the Midwest and the South was treated, with the exact same verbiage in our Enabling Act. So the idea that Utah should make control and make decisions of this is perfectly legitimate. And Utahns are competent to do it, and they should be empowered to do that. And I support that. It's not an issue of whether we have public lands. It's an issue of who actually decides, someone who lives here or someone who lives back in Washington. I choose the person who lives here.
Donna McAleer, your 30-second opportunity for rebuttal.
So again, those public lands are not owned by Utahns. They're owned by people in Des Moines, Iowa, in Boston, Massachusetts, and Tallahassee, Florida. They're owned by the 314 million Americans. And it's because of how these lands were divided, and it's because of things like the President Roosevelt's Antiquities Act that many of these lands have been protected. Again, we derive more than $600 million in revenue and in tourists coming to this state, as well as a thriving outdoor product industry.
I remind all of the candidates to be mindful of the clock that is displayed before them, indicating their allotted time. Representative Bishop, you have 30 seconds.
Look, it is still the same concept that these lands should be controlled by those who understand what they are doing. And the state of Utah is far more competent in managing these lands. We have shown in our subcommittee how state forests in Washington and Idaho are far more productive than federal forests that are abutting the state lands. We've also shown like Goblin Valley in Utah is a perfect place that would be an ideal destination spot. Currently, the area around it is controlled by the BLM. They walk in there once every 3 months. It should be given to the state so they can make it a destination spot. They can do a better job. Thank you.
Representative Rob Bishop has the first 90-second opportunity on our next subject, which shifts gears a bit. A group of politicians as diverse as President Obama, Texas Governor Rick Perry, and Republican Speaker of the House John Boehner, and others, have publicly stated America's immigration system is broken. What do you see as the major breaks in that system, and how do you propose a fix? Representative Bishop?
You know, in every time I have a town hall meeting, and I've had many of them, almost always the first question is about our immigration system. And the one thing I found out that permeates all those discussions is there is a great deal of anger and anxiety that is out there. And if we are going to come up with a solution, we have to, first of all, lower that anger and lower that anxiety level. And there's only one way of doing that, and that is being able to say we actually do have secure borders. If you do that, then that anxiety goes down, and you can move on to the other areas, which are visas, which are low-hanging fruit. Almost everyone agrees with that, and individual standalone bills have passed the House on all these issues. We can actually reach consensus to solve almost all of the problems if we realize the first thing you have to do is guarantee and look the people in the eye and really mean it, that the borders are secure, and then go on to the next step, which is how we reform our visa system, the E-Verify system, those types of things, and other issues that may be divisive. Wait on those until you can actually get more uniformity coming through. If we try to do an omnibus bill, as the Senate did, it's going to fail because you bring something that everyone hates. If you actually take this in a step-by-step pattern so you build consensus along the way, we can come up with not just a solution to our immigration issue, we can come up with a good solution to our immigration system. I'm confident that Congress will eventually do that, and sooner rather than later.
Donna McAleer, your opportunity on the subject of an immigration system, is it broken, and how might it be fixed?
The immigration system is broke, and the inaction by Congress is unacceptable. Yes, we need to secure our borders, but we also need to deal with the estimated 12 million undocumented immigrants that are already here. We can apply Band-Aid solutions, and the American people deserve a bipartisan decision on this, but it has to be debated and discussed in Congress, and Congress refuses to vote on this. I know. My mother and my grandfather fled Hungary in 1944, just before the Soviets entered to liberate the Hungarians from the Nazis. They came to this country through Ellis Island. My brother Marlon is a Filipino immigrant who was a tech sergeant based at Hill Air Force Base. And Allison, my sister, is from Korea, is a home health care aide in Maine. People deserve a path to citizenship. Those that want it. Not every undocumented worker who's coming here is coming for citizenship, but they're coming to make a better life. And a great example, Utah has actually been a leader in immigration reform with the Utah Compact that puts people first. And I think this should really serve as a national model where they provide a path to citizenship. It's straightforward and direct. We have a very complicated system. And remember, last summer, the Senate voted on a bill that addressed many of these issues. The House has refused to deal with it. We have religious leaders and business leaders calling for immigration reform.
Representative Bishop, your rebuttal opportunity.
Yeah, it's not quite that way. We actually did pass an immigration bill just in the last bill we did in the beginning of August before we came here that dealt with the flood of kids who are coming across the border in Texas. But it also had a security portion to it. It was the bill we had been talking about all the time to try and secure the southern border by making changes in the law that prohibit the Border Patrol from doing their job. They don't need more money. They don't need more manpower. They need simple access. That bill passed on a bipartisan vote in the House. It's a good bill. It would help solve that particular problem and would help solve other problems in the future, but it's one of the 350-plus bills still sitting on Harry Reid's desk that the Senate needs to consider and the Senate needs to debate on it. It's a good bill. It's much better than the Senate bill.
Donna McAleer, your 30-second opportunity.
Well, the children coming across the border, this is not about border security. They're surrendering at the border. They're escaping violent-ridden countries. They're escaping death. They're escaping rape. They're escaping harm. We need to deal with this as a humanitarian crisis. At the same time, we need immigration reform, and we need it passed at the federal level. Immigration is a federal issue. We need border security, and we need a clear path to citizenship, because our economy, every end of our economy, depends on having the best workers available.
Donna Meckler, you get the first opportunity to respond to this next question. And it was so lengthy when it came in from a voter, I am a little bit reluctant to read the entire length of the question. But there are three key words that sum it up, and I'd like your reaction to those three key words, whether it's working, whether it's not working, and what the future might be. Those three words are Affordable Care Act. You have the first 90-second opportunity.
So thank you so much. I believe the Affordable Care Act needs to be fixed and improved. There are some really great provisions of this, and I understand it. Having turned around a healthcare not-for-profit that served 25,000 residents of two counties, access to affordable health care is an economic issue. But the things that are great about the Affordable Care Act is nobody can be denied health care because of a pre-existing condition. What's really important in this state is young people under 26 can stay on their parents' policies. And something I'm very concerned about is women will not be charged more just because they're women. So instead of voting to shut down the government or voting 51 times to repeal a law that is on the books that went through the process as defined in our Constitution, it was brought up on the House, debated and discussed. It was passed and it moved to the Senate. The same thing happened. It was signed by the president. The Supreme Court upheld it, and a president was reelected. We need to sit down and find common ground, not throw up our hands, not vote 51 times to repeal a law. We need to work to fix it. Healthcare is an economic issue. It affects every single one of us. And if we don't think it does, we are anybody who has health insurance, their premiums go up because people without insurance have a tendency to go to the emergency room, which is at the highest cost point in the chain.
Representative Bishop, your 90-second opportunity on the theme of Affordable Care Act.
Okay, Affordable Care Act or Obamacare does need to be fixed. That's why there have already been seven bills that have passed the House and the Senate to change portions of it. And that's why the president refuses to enforce certain elements of it, because it is unsustainable and just flat out doesn't work. Stephen Shattuck had a much better version, a much better bill that should have been discussed on the House floor, but Speaker Pelosi would not allow that. Actually, right now, Dr. Price and Dr. Rowe, who are two members of the House, have two bills that are very good solutions and alternatives that would have a much, many of the things that are popular would be maintained. It's even like being able to be on your family's insurance until you're 20. Utah has always had that for years. You don't need the federal government to tell us. That's what we were doing before this ever came about. Bottom line is very simple. The Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, is not sustainable. It will not be sustainable in the future. There has to be changes to it. And the question will be, what will those changes be? There are some people that want to move it directly, much more to the left, and have a single standard payer. There are those that want to put more free market enterprise elements within it. That's going to be the debate of the future. What direction will we do? Obviously, it's not going to be repealed in the next 2 years. But at some time, we have to do something, because the track that this act is on right now cannot be financially sustained in the future. Something has to change. It was too early for prime time. It was passed too quickly, with actually less debate than we did on the resolution for ISIS. It was passed too quickly, and it needs to be changed, and how we change that is significant.
Donna Meckler, your rebuttal opportunity.
So again, when it was passed, the Congressional Budget Office reviewed the ACA, and it said it would reduce federal expenditures by $48 billion over a 10-year period, even after projected administrative costs. So opponents of the Affordable Care Act that say it will lead to bigger government are simply misinformed or really not representing the facts. The ACA hasn't even been in effect for a year. We need to look at its output before we start saying that it needs to be repealed. Who are the organizations lobbying for this? Insurance companies. That's who's going to lose out on some of their profit margins. And when you look at how candidates are funding, you needed to look at the insurance companies. That'll tell you who they're voting for.
Representative Bishop, I'm going to give you about 40 seconds for equal time on your rebuttal.
You don't need to do that. I can say this very quickly. The General Accounting Office has changed their estimates. They are now estimating it's going to cost much more. It is much less effective than they originally estimated, and it's not sustainable in the future. We're going to have to make changes whether you like it or not. What those changes are is going to be very significant. I'm done.
Okay, Representative, then you get the next opportunity at the next question.
Last one then. All right.
Our next question turns to a subject that you both addressed already in your previous comments. Congress has not been able to tackle many of, or successfully address many of the problems facing our country because of what the voter identifies as partisan gridlock. What would you do to help eliminate what appears to be a stalemate in our nation? Representative Bishop, you have the first 90-second opportunity.
Yeah, the stoppage in activity in Congress is not really a partisan one. The House is actually passing partisan bills all the time. It's one between the two houses of Congress, which is once again why we have passed over 350-plus bills, 70% of those with bipartisan votes, that still have yet to be taken up, discussed, or doing anything. They're still sitting on Senator Reid's desk. That's where the stoppage actually takes place. I'm actually proud. There was a story that came out recently that said I was the second most successful member of Congress in being able to bring resolutions or issues from the committee to the floor. I appreciate that. And the votes from our Resource Committee and the Armed Services Committee that I brought to the floor have all been passed either by a voice vote or they've been passed with Democrat support going forward. The bills I am still working on in the lame duck session all have Democrat co-sponsors. I really think there is a good deal of effort in the House to actually reach across party lines and get things done. The problem is it's still going to the Senate where the goal seems to be, I'm not really sure what. You know, when I was majority leader in the House and in the legislature in Utah, my job was to make sure the bills were kept going and so work was being done. Harry Reid is the majority leader in the Senate. I really think it's the opposite approach. He's trying not to have bills go forward and not get things done. And it may be a ploy of some kind, but it is very frustrating for us. Stoppage is not partisan. Stoppage is because of the two houses.
Donna McAleer, you have your 90-second opportunity on gridlock.
Well, real leaders take action, and real leaders work together. They don't place the blame on others or the other house. The government shutdown and the dysfunction and the gridlock occur in Congress because we don't hold our elected officials accountable for their work. If you, any of you in business, any of you in not-for-profit, first of all, you got to show up to work. This Congress was only in session less than 120 days. That's the first thing. Our founding fathers never meant for politics to be the full-time profession of a few. They meant for a representative form of government. They meant for people of diverse backgrounds to come to Washington to debate and discuss. But our House and our House and Senate won't even talk to each other. There's radical thinking on both ends of the spectrum. Here's something really interesting. This is all up to all of you. Every 2 years, we have an opportunity to replace 87% of our federal legislators. 87%. That's all 435 congresspeople and 33 senators. And what do? We send back 82%. And we expect a different result. Anybody who has studied any kind of history or science knows that's the definition of insanity. So it's time to send real problem solvers, not guardians of gridlock, back to Washington.
Representative Bishop, your rebuttal opportunity.
Look, I don't want to sound like I'm blaming everything on Harry Reid, but I am. In the last 8 years, we have passed 8 budgets. They have passed one. This year, we have passed 7 of our 12 appropriation bills. They haven't passed any. I'm already assigned to be one of the negotiators on the Defense Authorization Act. The Senate hasn't even picked it up in committee, so we're negotiating with them on amendments they haven't even met yet. And I'm sorry, it's very difficult to actually deal with that. In the House, we are passing things on a bipartisan basis, and we're doing continuously. They're going over to the Senate, and that's where they're staying. That has to change.
Rebuttal time for you, Donna McAleer.
Well, the bottom line is, we have a Congress that shut down the government for 16 days. It furloughed more than 40,000 people, working families in this state. It cost our state $30 million. I don't think we want this to happen again. But history is a great predictor of future performance. We've had 12 years of Representative Bishop in the House. It's time to give this guardian of gridlock a well-deserved retirement and put somebody in there who's actually had to deliver results.